Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm happy to have as my guest today John Lahr, whose most recent collection of profiles from The New Yorker, Profiles of Show People, called Honky Tonk Parade, has recently been published by the Overlook Press. There have been previous collections, as well as a book that I found when I was very young about a hero of mine, his father, Bert Lahr, on Notes on a Cowardly Lion. But of what I've read, this seems to be the best of the group of profiles, largely because, as you say in your preface, there's an alchemy that occurs between the person off stage and the person on stage, and you're looking to account for that alchemy.
To find it, yeah, and to report it.
And it seems to be there latently in the title, Honky Tonk Parade, which comes from a Bert Lahr lyric, which says, without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade.
Yeah, that's true. It's a, you mean a Yip Harburg lyric, I think.
Excuse me, what did I say?
Bert Lahr.
Oh, excuse me.
I wish he'd have sung. He sang some Harburg songs, but not that one.
And famously so,
yeah,
yes. But it seemed to me that many of these profiles are about people who perceive themselves to be without love or without a crucial love or love from someone.
That's a very perceptive thing to say. I've been with The New Yorker for 13 years, and writing profiles allows me to practice biography in a sort of mini way. These things take about 4 months to write and research. And at the end of it, I have like 1,000 pages of transcribed material. And I sort of think, as I write in the introduction, that it's a way. I grew up with a very powerful, resonant comic genius, Bert Lahr, who was very mysterious because he was very powerful on stage, and very astonishingly sorrowful and absent off stage, in his own world, you might say. But he was an absent presence, a lovable one, but a lost soul. So he went, and I could see it happen if I sat in the wings, from somebody who was authoritative and madcap to someone who was almost comatose. And my fascination, which is in itself autobiographical, I suppose, is how did that happen? What did the stage offer that my sister and I didn't offer? What changed this person from a man sort of palpably ordinary to someone who was spectacularly extraordinary? And what are the reasons for that? Why do people find the stage, need to perform, what is it they need to express to get out of themselves? And what are they saying, really? They're not just the words that they're saying. And you use the word people who are looking for love or something to that effect. The profile and the performer operate on the same principle, that people want to be seen. They want to have their essence acknowledged.
Last night, I was listening to that recording. I think it's from a radio broadcast of Bert Lahr and Ethel Merman singing Friendship. And as they're going through their woof, 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 give, give, give,
yeah,
you know, the
yeah,
whole...
Hep, hep, yeah,
yeah, there's a sense of a kind of crazy joy. Yes, those things were written out in Porter's Encore lyrics, but you hear Bert Lahr and Ethel Merman being ironic, crazy friends, madcaps, just in the quality of the recording. And I have always thought that it's up to the critic to find the words to describe that special quality.
Well, it is, and that is, if criticism is an art, and I think it can be, the art is to use language well enough not to distract from what the artists do, but to or compete with it, but to sort of zhuzh it along, to be there with it, to open it up, but in a way that is itself beautiful in a way, so that you're not – there's nothing worse than writing about – reading something about comedy that's not funny or that doesn't have a certain lightness in the – in its own presentation, you know? So you've got to match their energy with your own literary energy, but – one of the values of theater criticism is that it does – you have to be there. This thing that you're describing happens only once, which is the night you saw it. It'll be different the next night.
And yet I have to tell you that in Honky Tonk Parade, there's a moment that breaks the mold in a sense, so that the performative happens within the essay. It's in your essay on Bill Hicks, who was a young, intense – political, personal, I'd say spiritual,
very
humorist, and comedian. And between the reprint of the New Yorker profile, he died of pancreatic cancer. And there's a really grievous response from you in an addendum to that essay that it seems to me enacts something of the passion and crazy comic sense of loss of the human that he would enact on stage.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things, joy is hard. Life is hard. The people who actually can create joy, who can illuminate a moment with insight, not just with fun, but really clarify something about your spiritual condition. There are very few of them. And you can list them on one hand. And you can see them. I mean, when they come along, they're usually not altogether understood. I mean, you could say Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, Bill Hicks. But Hicks was talking about – he was trying to break the spell of the media on American audiences. I mean, the Americans don't understand how spellbound they are by the culture that they live in because it's so much fun. It's so – so happy, so buoyant. But he was really in his battle was to get across his comedy, which was terribly successful because it was ironic and biting. It was very successful in England, where I live, which is where I came in contact with him. And what was really interesting for me as a critic is usually critics follow behind the artist and sort of pick up the detritus of a life in the arts. But I've been lucky twice, once with the playwright Joe Orton, who was murdered, and I wrote a book about him, and his work, it helped to bring his work into the sort of canon of modern English drama. And with this situation with Hicks, Hicks was actually banned from the Letterman show. And I had written my profile, which the New Yorker had no peg for because from their point of view, he was a comedian who was successful in England that nobody had heard of. He was banned from Letterman, and he wrote me a 31-page letter. And that letter and excerpts from it, I filtered into my original profile. And the profile was published, and I print in the second part of this, the addendum you referred to, a letter that Hicks wrote to me afterwards, which was probably the most gratifying thing that I ever have received from the artist, which was simply to say that the effect of the thing being published in the New Yorker, his story and his comedy being explained, was that the audience that had eluded him was now finding him. And what I didn't know and what he wouldn't tell me was that he was dying and he had 4 months to live. And somehow his... To have gone, walked a few miles with him in the course of his short life has been very validating for me and for the enterprise of criticism, which is sometimes hard to justify in the world.
Well, you see, that's why I found it to be a kind of breakthrough piece and the piece that breaks the mold, first of all, because your son calls you to see him on the television, and then he reappears in the essay, lingering to hear Hicks talking.
Hicks came, we should say, Hicks came to my house, and my son, who had told me, come up and see this guy who was hilarious, came up to Hicks, and he was 16 at the time, he's now 29, and said, you know, how do you have the courage to say those things? And you know, Hicks, that was Hicks's job description. His job description was to say the unsayable. And he didn't know how to handle a question like that, you know, which is very interesting.
So you'll pardon me, but what I was feeling in the course of reading that piece, because I bet most people who read you in The New Yorker are not comparing profile to profile. They're enjoying and savoring each one. But here it was the father who's responding to his son's request to respond and find this as funny as the son finds it, and the comedian who comes over and enters a special parental relation with the critic, which is rare, and then the critic responding to an injustice, the banning from the Letterman show, and then after the death, almost, even though this addendum did not appear in The New Yorker, it breaks the wall of the profile. It's not, it's not holding the subject at any distance at all. There's an explosion after a description of an explosion on stage by the comedian in which he ends up telling someone who's told him in his audience that he sucks. He says, using words that I can't say on radio for reasons that the comedian would find appalling, he says, I ask you to find a soul.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, makes me cry.
Sure.
And then the following paragraph in which you go into a statement of really unrelieved grief, because this is a man who's praying, he says, to God to take him to reality and remove him from illusion, and to allow him to see the real.
That's right.
You know, I mean, what a killer
thing. Yeah, but that's the, that is a really spiritual soul. But all great laughter does that, of course, or is asking, or is trying to fight towards some sort of disenchantment. You know, we forget that in fairy tales, the enchanted are not free. The only free people are the disenchanted, and you have to work very hard for that disenchantment, you know. You know, it's also interesting to me, because when you were talking, making that connection with Hicks and my son, you know, as I said at the beginning of the conversation, my dad was a kind of absent presence. My sister and I loved dearly, but he was almost incorporeal. You know, he was much larger and more vivid on the stage than he was in life. And I think that the very process of doing these profiles, the labor, the looking, the asking, the digging to try to see where the chemistry comes from and how it's transformed into art, where the sadness becomes the failure, the limitation, is turned by the power of the artist into an asset. I think that's what I'm really trying to still keep looking at my dad. And as I think I mentioned in the introduction, I think it's a way, I didn't really realize this until I was writing the introduction, actually, of keeping this absent guy with me. And, you know, I'm still in, to a certain extent, I am in the business of keeping him and his ancestors and me in the discussion, our world, our theatrical world. And the world, I tend to believe that the artists of the culture are not only the architects of it, but what the culture is remembered by. So that while the public may see comedians and singers and actors as celebrities, I see them more as kind of the legislators of taste and style and the moment that we live in, and it's how, because they They legislate through joy, not through reason. So they speak to our irrational and unconscious longings in a way that legislation, you know, can't.
I'm talking with John Lahr here in the studios of KCRW. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. John Lahr is the author, most recently, of Honky Tonk Parade, a collection of his profiles for The New Yorker, published by Overlook Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Lahr about Honky Tonk Parade. I want to talk to you a little bit more about that joy. There's a beautiful quote from the poet Jack Gilbert as an epigraph to the book. It goes, "We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world." And it seems to me that one of the
things... my anthem.
Yeah.
I mean, I insist on joy. Life is a miracle, and we are miraculous, even in our evils, in a way.
And it's almost a given, even within most criticism, that the things that make us laugh or make us feel delight are not taken seriously.
Well, that's because we live in a Puritan culture. To a certain degree, there is nothing higher, in my view, because it is light, because it is, we've lost a sense in the culture of frivolity, for instance, the refusal to suffer. You know, I think that is one of the knock-on effects of terrorism. I mean, we are a culture that is terrified. So we are, you know, courage wants to laugh.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that poetry is the inexplicable, as is laughter. That it has a deep relationship to the thing that we're surprised by and start at, whether the start is the sudden rush of tears or the sudden losing it.
Well said.
And that the people in this book, and they range from Cole Porter, Billy Connolly, Mira Nair, Ang Lee, Dame Edna Everidge, Yip Harburg, Baz Luhrmann, they've all been capable of exciting responses that can't be anticipated, can't be sustained, can't be predicted, can't be maintained, and yet there they are.
They're inimitable.
Inimitable.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I once saw your father, my fourth grade teacher, describing Bert Lahr, had seen S.J. Perelman's play, The Beauty Part, and I made my parents take me to see it. Later, I watch him crawl up the side of the proscenium arch, expressing his fear in Foxy as the bad guys were crossing the stage. And there's no one. You could direct someone to climb the arch of the stage, but no one to express fear in that way and at that speed. And these are images that live behind one's eyes for the rest of one's life, seeing something that they do extraordinarily well, but in a way that no one else could do them.
Yes, all the great clowns live almost as dreams, because they are the surreal body. They transcend naturalism. They become metaphor. They bring and all the great early clowns. My father, Buster Keaton, Chaplin. You know, you name them, or most of them. The great ones brought their psychological baggage on stage with them, and they didn't understand it. They just exhibited it, and we interpreted it. You know, we got it. I mean, Dad's catchphrase was "ngong, ngong, ngong," and that says his bewilderment better than any literate or art. It's eloquent without being articulate. I mean, no, that's not right. It's eloquent without being literate. You know, it is just it is from the belly. It is from, it is a cry, which is maybe all one can put out into the world, but it absolutely eloquently expresses who he was.
Now, almost all the subjects of this collection, in ways that fascinated me, announced that there was a home that was so boring that they had to leave it. Kenneth Tynan wanted to put it far behind him. Dame Edna, making fun of it, has to flee its parochialism. So many of these people are people who are talking about a home life that was unbearable. Even Richard Rodgers, who maintains the unbearability into his future life, felt the desire to escape the coldnesses of a home that doesn't get him.
Right. Or in the case, of Yip Harburg, the whole emphasis on using language to delight his parents in order to distract them from their own immigrant fears and sadness, to just lighten their load, becomes a kind of mission of his own literary progress. Yes, I think that in that sense, all art is in some way doing battle with deadliness.
Oh, you just made me understand some. Would you say then about Harburg with his parents, because I've always thought, no one says this, but Harburg's skill is with the funny sounds of syllables running up against each other.
Yeah.
And we hear he is a whiz of a whiz, if ever a whiz there was.
Sure.
But was he talking to parents who spoke Yiddish?
Yes.
Who liked the nonsense sounds
Absolutely.
Of English?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah,
and they went to the Yiddish theater, and the father was playful, the mother was terrified, and he just wanted to, they were grief-struck. They were panic-struck. And he, Arlen always called Harburg the lemon drop kid. He didn't want to tolerate the blues. I mean, he wanted, although he wrote some of the greatest, saddest love songs, Last Night When We Were Young, for instance. But the impulse was to lighten their gravity, and to banish gravity is what all the clowns want to do, literally. And gravity is anything that weighs you down, and so that is the impulse of all these people. I mean, in the case of Dame Edna, which is interesting because Dame Edna is the one great living clown who is upper middle class and well educated, and in his case, he was a dandy. And I think that in a way, his pranks, he used to do these wonderful theatrical things before he ever was on the stage. When he was Barry Humphreys, who is the creator of this character. But he would do things like he would bury in England. They used to have those ash cans, garbage cans by the tubes and by the bus stops. He would go along and bury a split of champagne and a chicken, wrap it up and bury it in the trash, and then go away and dress up as a bum, just for his own pleasure, just to see people's responses, and rout in the garbage. And everybody sort of turns their head away because it's so humiliating. They just don't want to look at it. And then he would find this bonanza of champagne and chicken, and then just walk away and leave. It was enough for him to leave this little surprise in those people's minds. You were talking about this image behind the eyes, that those people who had seen that would always remember that moment. Of delight and surprise and astonishment, and he still to this day, in his last show on Broadway, he did this for me. Dame Edna always sings a song about her current incarnation, and when she came on the Broadway, not this last time, the previous show, the one that won the Tony, she was a born again Broadway star. And so I was sitting there reviewing the show, and I brought along a friend from the New Yorker, Nancy Franklin, who was the TV critic, who'd never seen him. And I'm sitting there taking notes, and he's singing Dominic's Spin Doctors Have Spun Me, Dominic's Done Me, I'm Even a Book by John Lahr, Call Me Old Fashioned, I'm a Born Again Broadway Star. Well, he didn't tell me about that. He knew that I would be in. He knew that it would slay me, that it would just knock me out. It would be something I would never forget. And that was that is like an antic spirit's entire motivation. He's not looking necessarily, it's a very private fun that he's having with the world. Sometimes it's to sort of mock them for their stupidity. Sometimes it's just to give somebody a moment of joy, a little surprise, something that really is ineffable. But that's just such a great and generous thing. And that spirit of generosity, which is a kind of vaudeville spirit, he is almost unique in taking what is almost entirely a moribund tradition and bringing it into the 21st century. I mean, those shows are really vaudevilles. And so it's got to be honored, because one of the things is it's not just that it's adequate or good, it is inspired. You know, I mean, he can take 2,000 people and infantilize them in a way that almost no one can now, where he can get them to admit. It's very funny. As I told you, I watched from the wings. I wrote my profile from the wings of the Drury Lane Theater. So I watched him every night, and I was looking at the audience. And when the audience left, it's like being underwater and watching seaweed. All they bend and back and forward and laugh. But they laughed in a very, very particular way. They laughed with their hands over their mouth, as if he was calling out of them some dangerous stuff that they were almost ashamed to be laughing at. And then they'd sort of clock their next-door neighbor there in the seat next to them, as if to say, was it good for you? But, you know, because we live in such a we have to live in such a kind of restricted, politically correct environment in order to survive, we need and we pay a lot of money to people who can artfully extract from us a sense of the infantile, to put us in touch with these dark things that have to find some expression, you know? And it's a great and necessary thing, you know, which can only happen in the dark, facing the stage.
I've been speaking with John Lahr, author most recently of Honky Tonk Parade, a collection of his New Yorker profiles of show people, published by Overlook Press. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Really,
it was a pleasure.
Yeah.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Take you through the ages, back to days of old, when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books.
Books can be funny, too.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
You've been listening to KCRW's Bookworm. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Good Food, a weekly exploration of culinary trends, tantalizing recipes, and intriguing discoveries in food and drink. Check out the podcast of Good Food at kcrw.com.